I often write in a certain way just because I haven't done it before or because I haven't done it in a long time, since I hate repeating myself. Though, of course, one always has to repeat oneself since one remains the same person, usually.
This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, the late, great John Ashbery. When John Ashbery died recently, it was front page news. Online and in print newspapers and magazines, poets and critics weighed in on Ashbery's enormous achievements. Ray Armantrout said Ashbery's poems are like involved daydreams from which there is no obvious exit. Eileen Miles said, of his generation, he was the last one standing and the great one. The tributes went on, and we're going to pile on here as well. My guest is Adam Fitzgerald, the author of two books of poetry and the founding editor of the poetry journal Maggie and a contributing editor to Lit Hub. Adam, you got to know John Ashbery quite well and even worked for him as an assistant for a time. But go back before you met him and tell me why you became such a big fan of his poetry. You loved his poetry before you met him.
That's right. I think I was so drawn to John's work because it seemed to give so much privilege and permission to the other parts of one's mind in the way that the front of our brain seems to dominate our economics and so much of what's odious about our politics and the world of kind of checks and account books and everything else. And that world's definitely throughout John's work. But he has so much fun with logic, warping and bending all the things that we take for granted about language and reality and experience. Ashbery's work was able to kind of fold and contain so many different kind of simultaneous realities and to evoke the kind of density of experience, as well as give respect and time and attention to those states of understanding or feeling that usually are more neglected, like confusion or the pleasures in something that's warped or perverted or silly or insignificant. And I think John's poetry is such a great way of almost reordering the world where logic or knowing what you're doing or having it all figured out, all of those illusions kind of break away. And every time you kind of sit down to the page to read his books or his poems aloud, you have to kind of not just rediscover what he means, but rediscover what you mean as a person. And I love that invitation to kind of dream awake.
You know, you loved him, his work, from a very early age when you were a young man. When I was a young man reading him for the first time, I think I was even in high school, he drove me crazy. And I think a lot of people have that response to him. And I don't think I really started to enjoy him until, I don't know, 15 years ago when I suddenly got his humor. I suddenly realized he was having a lot of fun in his poems. And then the door opened to John Ashbery for me.
Yeah, I think John Ashbery is the greatest comedic poet of all time.
He is funny.
He's funny and goofy and ridiculous and absurd.
And touching.
Yeah. But no matter how sad or strange or pathetic the circumstances that John's kind of writing about or describing or evoking in his poems, he never forgets the clumsy intrusions of pleasure, that at any moment in life, there are these weird and unexpected surprises and incongruencies, and that they kind of persist. And it's part of, it's, you know, thank God for humor. I always think of it as the kind of presiding spirit or angel of sanity and health and all that jazz.
Adam, I asked you to choose a few Ashbery poems from our website, and one of the ones you chose is called This Room. We actually recorded him reading it back in 2009, and before we hear it, I just want to play this very brief introduction he gave to it.
I wrote this poem in response to the death of a very dear friend, but like so many of my poems, I didn't set out to do that. I only realized after I'd written it that that was the subject of it, though someone who knew me might have been able to point it out even before I realized it.
That to me says a lot about John Ashbery, and the way he approached poetry and writing a poem. He often would sit down to write a poem without really knowing what he was going to do. He didn't often have a subject. In this case, he said he didn't know a subject until after he had written, and probably somebody else pointed it out to him. That's very unusual.
It is, and I think John's such a great, obviously uncanny example of someone who is so fully committed to what, you know, maybe in the early 20th century, we called automatic writing or sometimes surrealist writing. But, you know, if you think about the fact that we're all taught, you have an idea or an argument, and then you think about how you outline it and structure it, and then you think about the phrasing or kind of how you're going to kind of embody that into certain words put together. I think that's a great description of what John does if you just think of that in reverse.
Right.
And so John's really begins, as I think actually most poets do, kind of colliding different words together, and maybe a line will come to him, and that will be this thread through which a structure will emerge. And from a structure, maybe there's an argument or a mood or a flow of a mood. And then maybe after it's all over and done with and has been revised, there's a chance to look back and say, oh, wait, I guess I was having this idea, or maybe not at all. And so in a way, it's like letting the writing and the act of writing kind of lead the way.
Okay, let's hear this poem, which is on the shorter side for a John Ashbery poem.
This room. The room I entered was a dream of this room. Surely all those feet on the sofa were mine. The oval portrait of a dog was me at an early age. Something shimmers, something is hushed up. We had macaroni for lunch every day except Sunday, when a small quail was induced to be served to us. Why do I tell you these things? You're not even here.
So it's funny, it's enigmatic, and it's a little bit sad. In other words, it's a typical John Ashbery poem in many ways, and it grabs you right from the start with that wonderful first line.
The room I entered was a dream of this room.
I thought a lot about that line since I knew we were doing this podcast, and I still quite can't figure out what he means by that, but it draws us in.
That first line is somewhat of a sand trap, because if you think about a person entering a room and then they say, oh, this room I've entered, I've dreamed about. That makes sense.
Right.
But he says something different. And it's a subtle difference that kind of explodes logic. The room I entered was a dream of this room. The room he's talking about and the room he's inside of suddenly are kind of drifting away. Even as he's telling us that there's this kind of dream space that has kind of brought them together.
And then he wonderfully explodes that first line with a funny second line.
Surely all those feet on the sofa were mine.
Which is just wild. It's just so funny.
And if he had written, surely all those footprints on the sofa were mine.
That would make sense.
That would make sense.
And the humor returns in the second half of the poem.
We had macaroni for lunch every day except Sunday, when a small quail was induced to be served to us.
Induced to be served. It's a funny way to talk about one's lunch.
Not to mention it's a quail.
Yes.
You know, maybe in a Joseph Cornell box, this poem or this scene or that image you're referring to could happen, but it's not typical. I must have thought about this poem 1,000 times in my life, and I've gone back to it. I've recited it to myself. I was just speaking to my friend Emily, and she was saying how the poem always kind of terrified her slightly, or particularly that quail being induced to be served kind of sounds more like an execution. You induce a coma or you induce labor.
You know, if I hadn't heard his intro, I would have thought this poem was addressed to me, the reader, and not a friend who has died. Had you heard that intro before? Have you heard that interpretation of it? Did that throw you?
I've always interpreted the you, as you're feeling it, to be both absolutely addressed to me, the reader, and at the same time, to be a part of the poet, and at the same time, to be this kind of very elegiacal you, this kind of lost beloved, which is a figure that permeates so much love poetry and elegiac poetry, and clearly Pierre Morturi was such a close friend and lover of John's.
And he was the one, apparently, the poem was addressed to?
One can say yes to that without feeling like that's the only thing one could say yes to.
Why do I tell you these things? You're not even here.
Let me ask you something. I recorded Ashbery 2 or 3 times, I think, and I really enjoyed it. He was a lot of fun. He's a gentleman and kind of a wonderful reader. But I had other experience, a very different experience of going to hear him read in a poetry reading, which I found flat. And he would often mumble in a monotone, and he didn't seem to have a dramatic bone in his body. He did not dramatize his poems. And he's the absolute opposite of a Russian poet, for example. What do you make of that affect, that sort of flat affect that he had in his public persona?
I think that's a great thing to think about. John's kind of deadpan definitely pushed a lot of people away because after, in post-war American life, so many people, you know, first of all, poetry readings became a thing.
Right.
And they became a thing, as John writes about, when he came back from Paris in the mid-60s because of the Beats.
Mm.
And so much of, when we think of kind of someone like Ginsberg or Kerouac giving a reading, we think about that kind of passionate, overblown, very dramatic
yes.
reading style. But I've often found that that kind of subdued, withdrawn, seemingly quiet style of reading the poems, I find to be very affecting. I think it allows you to be drawn in and to be seduced just as much, if by very different means, as a more dramatic or stylized reading.
Yeah. John Ashbery is no longer with us, and we're going to have to read his poems on our own. And I wondered if I can get you to read a poem, I'm going to mispronounce the title, because it has some Latin in it, called E ut pictura poesis is her name. Tell us a little bit about this poem before you read it.
So this is a poem that John published in his collection, Houseboat Days. It's the collection immediately following Self-Portrait and Convex Mirror.
From the
70s, 1976, I believe, or 77, which won all the poetry awards, which John often referred to as the Triple Crown, as in, you know, the rarity of a horse winning all three of the major
I think
horses.
He's the only one to have won the big three poetry awards.
That's right.
Yeah, so there you go. He's our Triple Crown.
The title alludes to a trope of ekphrastic poetry that can be found in Horace and many later poets. And it refers to this kind of axiom or praxis that poetry should follow what painting does. To classical poets, Latin poets, they thought of poetry and painting as the sister arts. And so that, you know, as one goes, the other should go as well. And I think what's interesting to me about Ashbery as a poet is how much his poetry violates this very axiom that the title points to. It's not simply about descriptive representationality. It's not simply about the images cohering into a kind of graceful or classical pose. It's much more postmodern and dislocated than that. And in that way, you know, kind of repeat something John himself said somewhere, you know, I think his poetry is much closer to music than it is necessarily to painting.
Go ahead and give it a read. I'm not going to say the name of the title again. I'm going to leave that up to you.
And Ut Pictura Poesis is her name. You can't say it that way anymore. Bothered about beauty, you have to come out into the open, into a clearing, and rest. Certainly whatever funny happens to you is okay. To demand more than this would be strange of you. You who have so many lovers, people who look up to you and are willing to do things for you. But you think it's not right. But if they really knew you, so much for self-analysis. Now, about what to put in your poem painting. Flowers are always nice, particularly delphinium. Names of boys you once knew and their sleds. Skyrockets are good. Do they still exist? There are a lot of other things of the same quality as those I've mentioned. Now one must find a few important words and a lot of low-key, dull-sounding ones. She approached me about buying her desk. Suddenly the street was bananas and the clangor of Japanese instruments. Humdrum testaments were scattered around. His head locked into mine. We were a seesaw. Something ought to be written about how this affects you when you write poetry. the extreme austerity of an almost empty mind colliding with the lush, Rousseau-like foliage of its desire to communicate something between breaths, if only for the sake of others and their desire to understand you and desert you for other centers of communication, so that understanding may begin, and in doing so, be undone.
Again, it's funny and beautiful at the same time. He's having fun with the question of what should go into a poem and how you should say it. And the first thing he says is, you can't say it that way anymore, which is exactly what every poet must feel when they sit down and write a poem. You've got to do something different, something new. And I love how self-mocking and unself-serious this poem is. He says, flowers are always nice, particularly delphinium. And now one must find a few important words and a lot of low-keyed, dull-sounding ones. It's so true. And when you write a poem, you kind of use ordinary language with maybe a few fancy words in there.
It's true. I think of this poem as kind of happening in three movements, which I'm about to describe as I invent them before your very eyes. Okay. I think in the first movement, which opens with the great first line of the poem, you can't say it that way anymore. This is, I think, John kind of reckoning with the challenges of being a contemporary poet. You kind of can't say it the way that Keats or Milton or Sappho said it anymore, either because those languages are no longer the languages you speak and communicate in, or because that style or mode of address is no longer seems adequate to who you are or what people will listen to. And of course, the way that John says this is in a very vernacular American phrase. I mean, you can't say it that way anymore. You know, I can really kind of hear my parents speaking that way. In this opening line. And as he kind of becomes very self-conscious, he kind of closes that off with, you know, so much for self-analysis.
I know, I love that.
And I think that inaugurates the kind of second movement in the poem where we really kind of get to see how John imagines and reimagines the process of kind of creating something, something that can be both normal and everyday, like the names of flowers or skyrockets. And also kind of, you know, a queer relationality, you know, the names of boys or he locked his head into mine. And then at the very end, the poem kind of undoes itself, you know, all this desire to understand and communicate. Why do we go through all these work, you know, all this pressure and anxiety to communicate or be understood? Well, John tells us in this poem, so that understanding may begin and in doing so be undone. And I think we can say, yeah, when it comes to meaning can begin, but in doing so be undone is, of course, the mysterious Ashbarian addition to that dream of communication. And what would it mean to kind of undo
meaning?
Yeah.
I think that's a great description of what he does in a poem. He makes meaning and undoes it simultaneously.
Yeah, isn't it? What is it? Penelope every night is kind of sewing and unsewing something so that she wouldn't have to get hitched to the suitors.
Adam, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Fitzgerald's latest book is George Washington. You can read poems by Adam and by John Ashbery on our website, where you can also read many articles and essays about Ashbery. We love getting emails with your comments and suggestions. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org or write a review of the podcast in the iTunes store. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.